Part 3. The Third March. Chapter 18. Kamehameha. To piss across water is to piss across your reflection. Kyrgyz proverb. Early autumn, 4111, year of the tusk, southern Shigek. Sweating beneath the sun, the men of the tusk struck south, winding up the staggered escarpments of the south bank and onto the furnace plains of the Karathay Desert, or as the Kyrgyz called it, Ej-Ulkaya, the Great Thirst. The first night, they stopped near Tamiznay, a caravan entrepot that had been sacked by the retreating Fainim. Shortly afterward, Athgieri, who'd been sent to reconnoiter the route to Anathpania, returned from the southern waste, his men hollow-eyed with thirst and exhaustion. His mood was black. He told the great names that he'd found no unpolluted wells and that he'd been forced to travel by night. The heat was so intense. The heathen, he said, had retreated to the far side of hell. The great names told him of the endless trains of mules they'd brought and of the emperor's fleet that would follow them loaded with fresh Sempis water. They explained their elaborate plans for transporting that water across the coastal hills. You know not, the young Earl of Gainry said, the lands you risk. The following evening, the horns of Galioth, Nansur, Thunieres, Conraya, Setadon, and High Anon pealed through the arid air. Pavilions were torn down amid the shouts of soldiers and slaves. Mules were loaded and beaten into long files. The cultic priests of Gilgeol cast a goshawk onto their godfire, then released another to the evening sun. Infantrymen swung their packs from their spears, joking and complaining about the prospect of marching through the night. Hymns resolved and faded from the rumble of busy thousands. The air cooled, and the first column set across the western shoulders of Kamehameha's coastal hills. The first Kyrgyz came after midnight, howling from the backs of loping camels, bearing the truth of the solitary god and his prophet on the edges of sharp knives. The attacks were both brief and vicious. They fell upon stragglers, soaked the sands with red waters. They evaded the Enrithi pickets and swept howling into the baggage trains, where they sliced open the precious bladders of water wherever they found them. Sometimes, especially when they strayed onto hard gravel flats, they were overtaken and cut down in furious melees. Otherwise, they outdistanced their pursuers and vanished into the moonlit sands. The next day, the first mule trains crawled through the coastal hills to the Menenor and found a bay, quicksilver in the sun and peppered by the red-sailed ships of the Nansur fleet. There were hearty greetings as the first boatloads of water were dragged ashore. Songs were raised as the onerous work of transferring the water to the mules began. Men stripped to their waist, and many plunged into the rolling waves to relieve themselves of the heat. And that evening, when the holy war stirred from suffocating tents, they were greeted by fresh Sempis water. The holy war continued its nocturnal march. Despite the blood-curdling raids, many found themselves awed by the beauty of the Karathay. There were no insects, save the odd crazed beetle rolling its ball of dung across the sands. The Enrithi laughed at these, called them shit-chasers. And there were no animals except, of course, the vultures circling endlessly above. Where there was no water, there was no life. And apart from the heavy skins draped about the shoulders of the holy war, there was no water in the Karathay. It was as if the sun had burnt the whole world to sterile bone. The men of the tusk stood apart from the sun, stone, and sand, and it was beautiful, like a haunting nightmare described by another. It was beautiful because they need not suffer the consequences of what they witnessed. On the seventh assigned meeting between the Holy War and the Imperial fleet, the men of the tusk picked their way through dry gorges and gathered across the beaches. They looked across the Menenor, which was marbled by vast curls of lime and turquoise, and saw no ships. The rising sun gilded the sea in white. They could see the distant breakers, like lines of foaming diamonds, but no ships. They waited. Messengers were sent back to the encampment. Sauban and Confis soon joined them, bathed in the seawater for a time, spent an hour arguing, and then rode back to the Holy War. A council was called, and the great and lesser names squabbled until dusk, trying to decide what to do. Accusations were leveled against Confis, but were quickly dropped when the Exalt General pointed out that his life was as much at stake as theirs. The Holy War waited a night and a day, and when the Emperor's fleet still failed to arrive, they decided to continue their march. Many theories were aired. Perhaps, Icuri Confis suggested, the fleet had been beset by a squall and had decided to sail south to the next designated meeting point to conserve time. Or perhaps, Prince Kella suggested, there was a reason why the Kianin had waited so long to contest the seas. Perhaps the camels had been slaughtered and the fleet hidden to lure the Holy War into the Carathay. Perhaps Kamema was a trap. 2 days later, the bulk of the great and lesser names accompanied the mule trains across the hills to the sea and stared dumbfounded at its empty beauty. When they returned from the hills, they no longer walked apart from the desert. Sun, stone, and sand beckoned to them. All water was severely rationed according to caste. Anyone caught hoarding or exceeding their ration, it was declared, would be executed. In council, Icuri Confis unfurled maps inked by imperial cartographers in the days when Kamema had belonged to the empire and jabbed his finger at a place called Subas. The oasis of Subas, he insisted, was far too large for the heathens to poison. With the water remaining, the Holy War could reach Subas intact, but only if everything, mules, slaves, camp followers, was left behind. "Leave behind," Proya said. "How do you propose we do that?" Even though orders were dispatched with the utmost secrecy, word spread quickly through the drowsing encampment. Many fled to their doom in the open desert. Some took up arms. The rest simply waited to be cut down. Body slaves, camp whores, caste merchants, even slavers. Screams echoed over the dunes. Several riots and mutinies broke out among the Enrithi. At first, many refused to kill their own. The Holy War, the great names explained to their men, had to survive. They had to survive. In the end, countless thousands were murdered by the grief-stricken men of the Tusk. Only priests, wives, and useful tradesmen were spared. That night, the Enrithi marched blank-eyed through what seemed a cooling oven, away from the horror behind them, toward the promise of Subas. Men-at-arms, warhorses, and hearts had become beasts of burden. When the Kyrgwi found the fields of heaped bodies and strewn belongings, they fell to their knees and cried out in exultation to the solitary god. The trial of the idolaters had begun. The enormous column of the Holy War drifted and scattered in the rush southward. The Kyrgwi massacred hundreds of stragglers. Several tribes cut to the heart of the column, wreaking what havoc they could before fleeing into the waste. One group of raiders actually stumbled upon the Scarlet Spires and were burnt into oblivion. The following morning, the great and lesser names met in desperation. Water, they knew, had to lie all about them. The Kyrgwi couldn't harass them otherwise. So where were their wells? They called forward the more successful raiders among them, Athgieri, Thampus, Detnami, and others, and charged them with taking the battle to the desert tribes with the goal of finding their hidden wells. Leading thousands of Enrithi knights, these men rode over the long dunes and disappeared into the wavering distances. With the exception of Detnami, the Ainani Palatine of Eshkalas, they all returned the following night, beaten back by the ferocity of the Kyrgwi and the merciless heat of the Carathay. No wells had been found. Even if they had, Athgieri said, he had no idea how they might be found twice, so featureless was the desert. Meanwhile, the water had almost run out. With Subas nowhere in sight, the great names decided to put down all horses, save those belonging to caste nobility. Several thousand Kengemi footmen, Ketye tributaries of the Tidoni, mutinied, demanding that all horses be slaughtered and the excess rations be divided equally among all men of the Tusk. Gothyelk and the other earls of Setadon responded with ruthless alacrity. The leaders of the mutiny were arrested, gutted, then hung from pikes above the sand. Very little water remained the ensuing night, and the men of the Tusk, their skin like parchment, overcome by irritability and fatigue, began casting away their food. They no longer hungered. They thirsted, thirsted as they'd never thirsted before. Hundreds of horses collapsed and were left to snort their final breaths in the dust. A strange apathy descended upon the men. When the Kurgwi assailed them, many simply continued to walk, not hearing or not caring that their kinsmen perished behind them. Subbis, they would think, and that name became more fraught with hope than the name of any god. When dawn arose and they still hadn't reached Subbis, the decision was made to continue. The world became a hazy furnace of baked stone and dunes tanned and curved like a harlot's lovely skin. The distances shimmered with hallucinatory lakes, and many perpetually ran, convinced they saw the promised oasis, promised Subbis. Subbis, a lover's name. The men of the Tusk stumbled down long, flinty slopes, filed between sandstone outcroppings that resembled towering mushrooms on thin stems. They climbed mountainous dunes. The village looked like a many-chambered fossil unearthed by the wind. The deep green and sun silver of the oasis beckoned with its impossibility. Subbis. Ragged ranks surged across the sun-hammered sands. Men charged through the abandoned village, between date palms trailing skirts of dead fronds and acacias freighted with weavers' nests. They jostled, skidded across the packed dust, toppled, splashing and laughing into the glittering waters, where they found Detnami. Dead, bloated, floating in the crystal green, with all 459 of his men. The promise of Subbis had been poisoned. The Kurgwi had found a way. But the men of the Tusk were beyond caring. They gulped water and retched, then gulped more. Thousands upon thousands roared down the dunes and descended upon the oasis. They pushed and heaved at the masses before them, only to find themselves engulfed. Hundreds were crushed to death. Hundreds more actually drowned as men were shouldered into the pool's center. Some time passed before the great names could impose order. Thanes and knights warded men from the oasis at sword point. They were forced to make more than a few examples. Eventually, vast relays were organized to fill and distribute water skins. Swimmers began removing the dead from the pool. Bodies were heaped in the sun. The great names denied Detnami and his men funeral rites, realizing he'd struck south for Subbis instead of searching for Kurgwi Wells, obviously to save himself. Kefra Muni, the king regent of High Anon, denounced the Palatine of Eshkalis, posthumously stripped him of his rank and station. Ritual Anani curses were cut into his body, which was laid out for the vultures. Meanwhile, the men of the Tusk drank their fill. Many retired to the shade beneath the palms, leaning against trunks and wondering that fronds could so resemble vultures' wings. Their thirst slaked. They began to worry about sickness. The cultic physician priests of dread pestilence, Akiagni, were called before the great names, and they named those sicknesses associated with drinking water fouled by the dead. Otherwise, their pharmaca and their reliquary, abandoned to the desert, they could do little more than mutter preemptive prayers. The god would not be satisfied. Everyone was afflicted somehow, chills, cramps, nausea, but thousands became severely ill, stricken by convulsive vomiting and diarrhea. By the following morning, the worst were doubled over with abdominal pain, their skin blotched by angry red spots. In council, the great names stared and stared at Ikuri Confis's maps. Anathpania, they knew, was simply too far. They sent several dozen parties to various points on the Menenor coast, hoping against hope they might find the Imperial fleet. Accusations were leveled against the Emperor, and twice Confis and Saban had to be physically restrained. When the search parties returned from the hills empty-handed, the great names solemnly agreed to continue their southward march. Either way, Prince Kella said, the god would see to them. The men of the Tusk abandoned Subbis the following evening, their water skins brimming with polluted water. Several hundred, those too sick to walk, remained behind, waiting for the Kurgwi. Sickness spread among the men, and those without friends or kin were abandoned. The holy war became a vast army of shuffling men and stumbling horses, marching across blue vistas of sun-cracked stone and flint-strewn sand. About the nail of heaven, clouds of stars wheeled above them, numbering their dead. Those too sick to keep pace fell behind, wept in the dust like broken men, dreading the morrow's sun as much as the Kyrgwi. "Anathpania," the walkers said to one another, for the great names had lied, telling them Anathpania was only 3 days distant when it was more than six. "The god will show us to Anathpania." A name like a promise, like Shima. For those afflicted by diarrhea, the ration of water simply wasn't enough. Already weakened, they collapsed, panting against the cool sands. Many of the sickest died this way, thousands of them. After 2 days, the water began to run out. The thirst returned. Lips cracked, eyes grew curiously soft, and skin tightened, became as dry as papyrus and cracked around joints. There were some, very few, who seemed impossibly strong during this trial. Nurse Proyas was one of the few caste nobles who refused to water his horse while his men died. He walked among the steadfast knights and soldiers of Kunraya, giving words of encouragement, reminding them that before all, faith was a matter of trial. Followed by two beautiful women, Prince Kellis also spread words of strength. They didn't merely suffer, he told men. They suffered for Shima, for the truth, for the god. And to suffer for the god was to secure glory in the outside. Many would be broken in this furnace, that was true, but those who survived would know the temper of their own hearts. They would be, he claimed, unlike other men. They would be more. The chosen. Wherever Prince Kellis and his two women went, men crowded about them, begging to be touched, to be cured, to be forgiven. Stained by dust into the color of the desert, his face bronzed and his flowing hair almost bleached white, he seemed the very incarnation of sun, stone, and sand. He and he alone could stare into the endless Carathay and laugh, hold out his arms to the nail of heaven and give thanks for their suffering. "The god chooses," he would cry. "The god!" And the words he spoke were like water. On the third night, he halted in a vast bowl between dunes. He marked a place across the trampled sands and bid several of his closest adherents, his Zao Dunyani, to begin digging. When they despaired of finding anything, he commanded them to continue. Very soon, they felt moisture in the sand. Then he walked farther and bid those rushing past to dig more holes at various places. Others he organized into an armed perimeter. Held back by hedges of leveled spears, wondering thousands crowded around the lip of the depression, curious to see what happened. After several watches, some 14 pools of dark water glittered in the moonlight. Spring-fed wells. The waters were muddy, but they were sweet, and unfouled by the taste of dead men. When the first of the great names at last beat and hollered their way to the floor of the depression, they found Prince Kellis at the bottom of a pit, standing knee-deep in waters with a dozen others, hoisting brimming skins to the groping hands above. "He showed me," he laughed when they hailed them. "The god showed me." More wells were dug at the behest of the great names, and water relays were once again organized. Since most of the holy war had suffered severe dehydration, the great names decided to linger for several days. The remaining horses were butchered and eaten raw for lack of fuel. In the councils, Prince Kellis was congratulated for his discovery, but little more. Many in the holy war, especially the caste menials, openly hailed him as the warrior prophet. In closed meetings, the great names argued over the Prince of Atrathau, but they could find no consensus. The desert, Ikiri Confis warned, had made a false prophet of Fane as well. Meanwhile, the Kyrgwi tribes gathered in the deep desert, thinking the holy war, like a jackal, had found its place to die. The following night, they attacked en masse, a wild rush of thousands spilling from the crests of dunes, confident they would ride down more corpses than men. Though surprised, the men of the Tusk, their flesh revived, their faith renewed, encircled and slaughtered the desert tribesmen. Entire tribes, who'd bled much through the endless skirmishes across Kamehameha, were extinguished. The survivors withdrew to their hidden oasis homes. The last of the food gave out. Water skins were once again filled and heaped across strong backs. Songs were raised across the dark desert landscape, many of them hymns to the warrior prophet. The holy war resumed its southward march, unconquered and defiant. Between Mengeta, Anwarat, and the desert, they had lost almost a third of their number. But still, their great columns spanned the horizon. They crossed deep wadis, cut by the infrequent winter rains, and climbed rolling dunes. They laughed once again at the shit-chasers scurrying with their dung across the sands. Day came, and they perched their canvas sheets against the punishing sun so they might sleep through the merciless heat. As evening fell on the second day, and the encampment once again made ready to march, many noticed clouds across the western sky, the first clouds they'd seen, it seemed to them, since Gedea. They were smeared across the horizon, deep purple, and they folded around the setting sun so that it seemed the iris of an angry red eye. Without their omen texts, the priests could only guess at the meaning. The air still shimmered with heat, rolled like water over the sun-baked distances, and it was still, very still. A hush fell across the reaches of the holy war. Men peered at the horizon, looked nervously at the wrathful eye, realizing the clouds belonged to the ground, not the sky. And then they understood. Sandstorm. With the sluggish elegance of a scarf coiling in the wind, pummeling clouds of dust rolled toward them from the west. Old Carathay could still hate. The great thirst could still punish. Skin-serrating blasts, gusts with a million stinging teeth. The men of the Tusk howled to one another without being heard. They tried to look, perhaps glimpsed the shadowy figures of others through the brown haze, but were then blinded. They huddled in clots beneath the biting wind, felt the sand suck at them as it heaped around their limbs. Their makeshift shelters were torn away, thrashed like paper through mountainous gusts. A new calligraphy of dunes was scrawled about them. Forgotten waterskins were buried. The sandstorm raged until dawn, and when the winds receded, the men of the Tusk wandered like stunned children across a transformed land. They salvaged what they could of their remaining baggage, found several dead men buried beneath the sands. The great and lesser names met in council. They hadn't enough shelter from the sun, they realized, to remain through the day. They must march, that much was clear. But where? Most argued that they should return to the well discovered by Prince Kellis, as he was still called in the councils, as much by his own insistence as by the loathing some had taken to the name Warrior Prophet. At least they had enough water to make it that far. But the dissenters, led by Ikuri Confis, insisted the well was likely lost to the sands. They pointed to the surrounding dunes, so bright in the sun they sheared one's eyes, and insisted the land around the wells was certain to have been just as disfigured, if not more. If the holy war used its remaining water to march away from Anathapania, and the wells couldn't be found, then it was doomed. As it stood, Confis claimed, once again relying upon his map, the holy war was within 2 days' march of water. If they marched now, they would suffer, certainly, but they would survive. To the surprise of some, Prince Kellis agreed. Surely, he said, it's better to wager suffering to avoid death than to wager death to avoid suffering. The holy war marched toward Anathapania. They passed beyond the sea of dunes and entered land like a burning plate, a flat stone expanse where the air fairly hissed with heat. Once again, the water was strictly rationed. Men became dizzy with thirst, and some began casting away armor, weapons, and clothes, walking like naked madmen until they fell, their skin blackened by thirst and blistered by sun. The last of the horses died, and the footmen, ever resentful that their lords tended to their mounts more faithfully than to their men, would curse and kick gravel at the wooden corpses as they passed. Old Gothjalk collapsed and was strapped to a litter made by his sons, who shared their rations of water with him. Lord Gunyati, the Cunryan Palatine of Ancirioth, whose bald head looked so much like a blistered thumb jutting from a torn glove, was bound like a sack to his horse. When night had at last fallen, the Holy War continued its march south, once again stumbling along the backs of sandy dunes. The men of the Tusk walked and walked, but the cool desert night provided little relief. None talked. They formed an endless procession of silent wraiths, passing across Carathay's folds. Dusty, harrowed, hollow-eyed, and with drunken limbs they walked. Like a pinch of mud dropped in water, they crumbled, wandered from one another, until the Holy War became a cloud of disconnected figures, feet scraping across gravel and dust. The morning sun was a shrill rebuke, for still the desert had not ended. The Holy War had become an army of ghosts. Dead and dying men lay scattered in their thousands behind it, and as the sun rose, still more fell. Some simply lost the will and fell seated in the dust, their thoughts and bodies buzzing with thirst and fatigue. Others pressed themselves until their racked bodies betrayed them. They struggled feebly across the sand, waving their heads like worms, perhaps croaking for help, for succor. But only death would come swirling down. Tongues swelled in mouths. Parchment skin went black and tightened until it split about purple flesh, rendering the dying unrecognizable. Legs buckled, folded, refused one's will as surely as if one's spine had been broken. And the sun beat them, scorching chapped skin, cooking lips to hoary leather. There was no weeping, no wails or astonished shouts. Brothers abandoned brothers, and husbands abandoned wives. Each man had become a solitary circle of misery that walked and walked. Gone was the promise of sweet Sempis water. Gone was the promise of Anathpenea. Gone was the voice of the warrior prophet. Only the trial remained, drawing out warm, thrumming hearts into an agonized line, desert thin, desert simple. Frail heartbeats, stranded in the wastes, pounding with receding fury at seeping, water-starved blood. Men died in the thousands, gasping, each breath more improbable than the last, at furnace air, sucking final moments of anguished, dreamlike life through throats of charred wood, heat like a cool wind, black fingers twitching through searing sands, flat, waxy eyes raised to blinding sun. Whining silence and endless loneliness. Esmenet stumbled by his side, kicking sand and fiery gravel with feet she could no longer feel. Above her, the sun shrieked and shrieked, but she'd long ceased worrying how light could make sound. He carried Serwe in his arms, and it seemed to Esmenet that she'd never witnessed anything so triumphant. Then he stopped before a deep and dark vista. She swayed, and the wailing sun twirled above her, but somehow he was there, beside her, bracing her. She tried licking cracked lips, but her tongue was too swollen. She looked to him, and he grinned, impossibly hale. He leaned back and cried out to the hazy roll and pitch of distant green, to the wandering crease of a flashing river, and his words resounded across the compass of the horizon. "Father, we come, Father!" Early Autumn, 4111, Year of the Tusk, Iothea. Zynemus's fierce scowl silenced him, and the three men retreated into a grotto of darkness, where the wall pinched one of the compound structures. They dragged the warrior slave's corpse with them.
"I always thought these bastards were tough,"
Bloody Dinch whispered, his eyes still wild from his kill.
"They are,"
Zynemus replied softly. He scanned the gloomy courtyard below them, a puzzle box of open spaces, bare walls, and elaborate facades.
"The Scarlet Spires purchase their javra from the Shrank Pits. They are hard men, and you'd do well to remember it."
Zenkappa smirked in the dark and added,
"You got lucky, Dinch."
"By the prophet's balls, Bloody Dinch hissed. I shhed. Zynemus spat. Both Dinch and Zenkappa were good men, fierce men, Zynemus knew, but they were bred to battle in open fields, not to slink through shadows as they did now. And it bruised Zynemus in some strange way that they seemed incapable of grasping the importance of what they attempted. A Commian's life meant little to them, he realized. He was a sorcerer, an abomination. A Commian's disappearance, the marshal imagined, was a matter of no small relief to the two of them. There was no place for blasphemers in the company of pious men. But if they failed to grasp the importance of their task, they were well aware of its lethality. To skulk like thieves among armed men was harrowing enough, but in the midst of the Scarlet Spires? Both were frightened, Zynemus realized, thus the forced humor and empty bravado. Zynemus pointed to a nearby building across a narrow portion of the courtyard. The bottom floor consisted of a long row of colonnades, framing the pitch black of its hollow interior.
Those abandoned stables, he said. With any luck, they'll be connected to those barracks. Empty barracks, I hope, Dinch whispered, studying the dark confusion of buildings. So they look. I'll save you, Akamian. Undo what I've done.
The Scarlet Spires had taken up residence in a vast, semi-fortified complex that looked as though it dated back to the age of Kanae, the sturdy palace of some long-dead Kanaean governor, Zynemus supposed. They had watched the compound for over a fortnight, waited as the great trains of armed men, supplies, and slave-born litters wound from the narrow gates into Iothea's labyrinthine streets to join the march across Kamema. Zynemus had no definite idea of the size of the Scarlet Spire's contingent, but he reckoned it numbered in the thousands. This meant the compound itself must be immense, a warren of barracks, kitchens, storerooms, apartments, and official chambers. And this meant that when the bulk of the school traveled south, those few remaining would find it difficult to defend against intruders. This was good, if, in fact, a Commian was actually imprisoned here. The Scarlet Spires wouldn't dare take a Commian with them. Zynemus was sure of that much. The road was no place to interrogate a mandate sorcerer, especially when one marched with a prince such as Proyas. And the fact that the Scarlet Spires had actually left a mission here meant that the school had unfinished business to attend to in Iothea. Zynemus had wagered that a Commian was that unfinished business. If he wasn't here, then he was very likely dead.
He's here. I feel it.
When the three men reached the interior of the stables, Zynemus clutched at the trinket about his neck, as though it were holier than the small golden tusk that clicked at its side. The tears of God, their only hope against sorcerers. Zynemus had inherited three trinkets when his father had died, and this was the reason he attempted this with only Dinchazes and Zenkappa. Three trinkets for three men about to wander into a den of abominations. But Zynemus prayed they wouldn't need them. Whatever their sins, sorcerers were men, and men slept.
Hold them in your bare fists, Zynemus commanded. Remember, they must be touching your skin to afford you any protection. Whatever you do, don't let it go. This place is sure to be protected by wards, and if the trinket leaves your skin even for a moment, will be undone.
He ripped his own trinket from about his neck and felt comforted by the cold weight of its iron, the imprint of its deep runes against his palm. The stalls hadn't been mucked, and the stables smelled of dried horse shit and straw. After several moments of fumbling, they found a passageway that led them into the abandoned barracks. Then their nightmarish journey through the maze began. The complex was as huge as Zynemus had both hoped and feared, and as much as he was relieved by the endless series of empty rooms and corridors, he despaired of ever finding a Commian. Once or twice they heard distant voices speaking Ainani, and they would crouch in pit shadows or behind exotic Kianine furniture. They passed through dusty audience halls, filled with enough moonlight that they might wonder at the grand geometric frescoes across the vaulted ceilings. They skulked by sculleries and kitchens and heard slaves snoring in the humid dark. They crept up stairs and down halls lined by apartments. Each door they opened, seemed hinged upon a precipice. Either a Kamian or certain death lay on the far side. Every instant, every breath seemed an impossible gamble. And everywhere they imagined the ghosts of the Scarlet Magi, holding arcane conferences, summoning demons, or studying blasphemous tomes in the very rooms they glided past. Where were they holding him? After some time, Synemus began to feel bold. Was this how a thief or a rat felt, prowling at the edges of what others could see or know? There was exhilaration, and strangely enough, comfort in lurking unseen in the marrow of your enemy's bones. Synemus was overcome by a sudden certainty.
We're going to do this. We're going to save him. We should check the cellars,
Dinch hissed. A sheen of sweat covered his grizzled face, and his gray, square-cut beard was matted.
They'd put him somewhere where his screams couldn't be heard by visitors, wouldn't they?
Synemus grimaced, both at the loudness of the old majordomo's voice and at the truth of what he said. A Kamian had been tortured and tortured long. It was an unbearable thought.
Akka.
They returned to a stone stairwell they'd passed, descended down into pitch blackness.
We need some light, Zenkappa exclaimed. We won't be able to find our hands down here.
They stumbled blindly into a carpeted corridor, packed close enough together to smell the sweat of one another's fear. Synemus despaired. This was hopeless. But then they saw a light, and a small sphere of illuminated hallway, moving. The corridor where they found themselves was narrow, with a low, rounded ceiling. They could see this now, and exceedingly long, as though it ran the greater length of the compound. A sorcerer walked through it. The figure was thin, but dressed in voluminous scarlet silk robes with deep sleeves embroidered with golden herons. His face was the clearest because it was bathed in impossible light. Rutted cheeks, lost in the slick curls of a lavishly braided beard, bulbous eyes, bored by the tedium of walking from place to place, all illuminated by a teardrop of candlelight suspended a cubit before his forehead, without any candle. Synemus could hear Dinch's breath hiss through clenched teeth. The figure and the ghostly light paused at a juncture in the corridor, as if he had stumbled across a peculiar smell. The old face scowled for a moment, and the sorcerer seemed to peer into the darkness at them. They stood as still as three pillars of salt, three heartbeats. It was as though the eyes of death itself sought them. The man's scowl lapsed back into boredom, and he turned down the juncture, trailing a momentary skirt of illuminated stonework and scrolled carpet in his wake. And then, blackness.
Sanctuary. Dear sweet Sejanus, Dinch gasped. We must follow him,
Synemus whispered, feeling his nerves gradually calm. Witnessing the face, the sorcerer's light now made their every step sing with peril. The only thing keeping Dinchazes and Zenkappa behind him, Synemus knew, was a loyalty that transcended fear of death. But here, in this place, in the bowels of a Scarlet Spire's stronghold, that loyalty was being tested as it had never been tested before, even in the heart of their most desperate battles. Not only did they gamble with the obscenely unholy, there were no rules here, and this, added to mortal fear, was enough to break any man. They found the juncture but could see no light down the other corridor, so they inched blindly forward as they had before, following the limestone walls with their fingers. They came to a heavy door. Synemus could see no light seep around it. He grasped the iron latch, hesitated.
He's close. I'm sure of it.
Synemus pulled open the door. From the drafts across their humid skin, they could tell the door opened upon a large chamber, but the darkness was still impenetrable. They felt as though they were entombed in dread night. Holding a hand before him, Synemus stepped into open blackness, hissed at the others to follow. A voice cracked the silence, stilled their hearts.
But this will not do.
Then lights, blinding, stinging bright and bewildering. Synemus yanked free his sword, blinked and squinting, focused on the figures congregated about them. A half circle of a dozen Javra, fully geared for war beneath blue and red coats, six of them with leveled crossbows. Stunned, his thoughts reeling in panic, Zynemus lowered his father's great sword.
We're undone.
Behind stood three of the Scarlet Magi. The one they'd seen earlier, another much like him, but with a beard dyed in yellow henna, and a third, who from his very bearing Zynemus knew, had to be the senior. Against his crimson gown, the man was more than pale, he was devoid of pigment. A canv addict, no doubt. One small obscenity to heap upon all the others. About his waist, he wore a broad blue sash, and over it, a golden belt pulled low to his groin by a heavy pendant that hung between his thighs, serpents coiled about a crow. The red-irised eyes studied them, pained by amusement.
Tisk, tisk, tisk,
from lips as translucent as drowned worms.
Do something. I must do something.
But for the first time in his life, Zynemus was paralyzed by terror.
Those things, the sorcerer addict continued, that you clutch to protect yourselves against us, those trinkets, we can feel them, you know, especially when they grow near. Hard sensation to describe, really. Kind of like a stone marble pitting a thin sheet of cloth. The more marbles, the deeper the pit.
The flicker of translucent eyelids.
It was almost as though we could smell you.
Zynemus managed to sound defiant.
Where's Drusus Acarmian?
Wrong question, my friend. If I were you, I should rather ask, what have I done?
Zynemus felt the flare of righteous anger.
I'm warning you, sorcerer. Surrender Acarmian.
Warn me?
Droll laughter. The man's cheeks fluted like fish gills.
Unless you're speaking of inclement weather, Lord Marshal, I think there's very little you could warn me about. Your prince has marched into the wastes of Kamema. I assure you, you're quite alone here.
But I still bear his writ.
No, you don't. You are stripped of your rank and station. But either way, the fact is, you trespass, my friend. We schoolmen look very seriously upon trespass, and care nothing for the writ of princes.
Humid dread. Zynemus felt his hackles rise. This had been a fool's errand.
But my path is righteous.
The sorcerer smiled thinly.
Tell your clients to drop their trinkets. Of course, you may drop yours as well, Lord Marshal. Carefully.
Zynemus glanced apprehensively at the leveled bolts, at the stone-faced Javra who aimed them, and felt as though his life was held from a string.
Immediately!
The mage snapped. All three trinkets thudded like plums against the carpets.
Good. We're fond of collecting kore. It's a good thing to know where they are.
Then the man uttered something that turned his crimson irises into twin suns. Zynemus was thrown to his knees by a blast of heat from behind him. He could hear shrieking. Dinch and Zenkappa shrieking. By the time he turned, Dinch had already fallen, a heap of writhing char and incandescent flame. Zenkappa flailed and continued to shriek, immolated in a column of blowing fire. He stumbled two steps into the dark corridor and collapsed onto the floor. The shrieks trailed into the sound of sizzling grease. On his knees, Zynemus stared at the two fires. Without knowing, he'd brought his hands up to cover his ears.
My path.
He felt gauntleted hands clench him, powerful limbs pin him to his knees. He was wrenched around to face the canv addict. The sorcerer was very near now, near enough that the marshal could smell his Aenani perfumes.
Our people tell us,
the addict said, in a tone which suggested that untoward things were best not mentioned in polite company,
that you're Acarmian's closest friend, from the days when you both tutored Proyas.
Like a man unable to fully rouse himself from a nightmare, Zynemus simply stared, slack-faced. Tears streamed down his broad cheeks.
I failed you again, Akka.
You see, Lord Marshal, we worry that Drusus Acarmian tells us lies. First, we'll see if what he's told you corresponds with what he's been telling us, and then we shall see if he values the Gnosis over his closest friend. if he values knowledge over life and love.
The translucent face paused as though happening across a delicious thought.
You're a pious man, Marshal. You already know what it means to be an instrument of the truth, no?
Yes, he knew. To suffer. Heaps of masonry nested in ashes, truncated walls hedged by rubble, sketching random lines against night sky, cracks forked like blind branches chasing elusive sun, spilled columns halved by moonlight, scorched stone. The library of the long-dead Sariots, ruined by the avarice of the Scarlet Schoolmen, silent save for the small sound of scraping like a bored child playing with a spoon. How long had it scuttled like a rat through the hollows, crawled through the labyrinthine galleries hewn by the random plunge of cement and stone, past entombed texts, wood blackened and crocodile scaled by fire, and once a lifeless human hand, through a tiny mine whose only ore was the debris of knowledge, upward, always upward, digging, burrowing, crawling. How long? Days, weeks? It knew very little of time. It shrugged its way through torn animal skin pages, pinched by massive surfaces of stone. It heaved aside a palm-sized brick, raised a silky face to the cloud of stars. Then it climbed and climbed, and at last lifted its small puppet body upon the summit of the ruin, raised a little knife, no bigger than a cat's tongue, as though to touch the nail of heaven. A Wathi doll, stolen from a dead Sensori witch. Someone had spoken its name.